ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் போஸ் ஃபவுண்டேஷன் அண்ட் வெஜிடேரியன் அண்ட் ஃபைனலி பரம்பரா, பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க் யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
The third part of non-stealing, of course, is not coveting, and that's even more subtle than inappropriate forms of debt, because it's all in the mind. It's not in our actions, it's just in what we do with our mind. So Webster tells us, covetousness is an excessive desire for wealth or possessions. Not a desire, but an excessive desire. We're really focused. We really want. We want possessions. We want money. Gurudeva describes it as owning something mentally and emotionally, but not actually owning it physically. So we want something. It doesn't belong to us. We're treating it as if we have it, but it's not ours. So how does coveting cause problems? Well, as we were talking about, you get into abusive credit. Because you want something a great deal, you go out and you buy it, and you abuse the credit to buy it. If you didn't want it, you wouldn't buy it, right? So the problem isn't the buying, it's the wanting. We wanted it so much that we were reckless in how we determined we could pay for it. We weren't realistic. We weren't following the principle of proper use of credit. So, of course, we've all experienced this. A new computer comes out, right? Twice as fast as the one we all have. Of course, we all want it. We can get our work done twice as fast. This is good. So the problem is, of course, in this example, we buy it and sell the one we have, and we end up with a monthly payment we really can't afford to make. So our excessive desire has caused us to buy something we can't afford. Then we've got a payment we can't make. So that's not very good, but if we do that a number of more times with other objects, obviously our coveting is going to get us into serious financial trouble. So not only does coveting lead to abusive credit, leads to other problems as well. Can lead to envy and even jealousy. If what we want isn't owned by a company but happens to be owned by the person next to us at work, person next to us at home, person next to us at school, if they have something that's better than what we have and we want what they have, then our coveting is starting to bring up feelings of envy and possibly even jealousy, like among brothers or sisters. One of them has something, the other doesn't. You want it, pretty soon, a lot of jealousy. So the Kural gives some, the Kural, which is the Tirukural, which is a South Indian scripture, gives us some good advice on avoiding covetousness as well as envy. So the first one's on covetousness. There's a whole chapter on it. It's a common problem all mankind faces. Nobody is exempt. There is a thoughtless desire for others' things that is destructive. There is a mindful pride that, in refusing to covet, is triumphant. Then on envy, there are no envious men who have risen to prosperity. There are no men free from envy who have fallen from it. As we've said, the tendency to acquire and hoard possessions for ourselves, as well as the willingness to steal to accomplish this in subtle or gross ways, is part of our instinctive nature. We want to gather up everything we can, keep it for ourselves, to feel secure. Then we have enough to eat and so forth. It's just part of the instinctive nature we see in animals. Animals don't go around sharing their food with one another. You know, put out the food and watch the animals fight over it, right? So, just part of the instinctive nature. So harnessing it, of course, is the challenge. And as we talked about, harnessing desire, or the tendency to covet, is a good step toward restraining this tendency. If we don't want things so much in the first place, we won't abuse credit, we won't get into envy and jealousy regarding them. But that isn't enough. We can go even further and fully conquer this instinctive aspect of our nature through practicing charity, giving, dana. And why is that? Because it's the opposite. If we're giving things away, that's the opposite tendency of hoarding everything for ourselves. So obviously, we can't be in both states of mind at the same time. If we're generous and giving and thoughtful of others, that's taking this tendency to be selfish, hoard things, and even steal them, and really minimizing it in a very nice way. So the Koral has a whole chapter on charity as well, one verse. Is it because they are unaware of the joys of giving that hard-hearted men waste their wealth by hoarding it? So that hits the point quite accurately. The one extreme is, there we are, we're gathering all this in, and what are we doing with it? We're hoarding it. Does it make us feel happy, joyful? Not really. So we can go the other direction and also be generous toward others, give, think about others, be unselfish. It brings a lot more happiness than just keeping it all for ourselves. What they call, Tirukkural calls that the joys of giving versus the emptiness of hoarding. Gurudeva has a nice commentary on this principle. To restrain one's instinctive tendencies successfully, each must be replaced by a positive observance. For each of the yamas, there is a positive replacement for doing something else. So in this case, the tendency is to hoard everything for ourselves, be selfish, steal, want what other people have, take it. And the opposite quality is to be generous, give away part of what we have. Keep enough for our family, but be generous. Give, think about the needs of others. The first yama, of course, was non-injury, hurting others, and simple replacement for that one, of course, is helping others and being helpful toward other people, trying to help them do well and succeed and help meet their needs. So we can find an opposite one, opposite quality for each of these tendencies we're talking about. So we could even take the principle of charity one step further. Charity is excellent, but we can take it further by following certain practices to spiritualize our household finances, to bring religion into the financial world. In other words, it's one of the important qualities of Hinduism. We don't separate the religious from the secular. There's not one part of our life called secular life and another part of our life called religious life. This part happens during this part of the day and that part happens during the other part of the day. No, it doesn't work like that. The religion permeates life 24 hours a day, even in our dreams. We're practicing our religion by what we do and what we don't do. So we can bring in spiritual influences into our finances, household finances, and move us even further away from the tendency to covet. So how can we do that? Well, this is the description we sometimes send out on email when devotees write in asking for advice in this area. So I'll just read what the email says. Starts out in a very general way. Many Hindus go to the temple the first day of the year, attend puja or archana, and write the first check of the year to the temple as a donation. Sometimes we have Hindus coming here. We have two New Years, so sometimes it happens January 1, and other times it happens April 14th. But usually each year, we have a few devotees coming here and writing their first check on one of those 2 days. The idea behind this custom is that one's financial life for the coming year is receiving the God's blessings of Siddhi and Buddhi, meaning success and wisdom. When applied to our livelihood, the blessing of Siddhi can increase prosperity, ensuring that our income will be more abundant. And Buddhi can give us the knowledge and discrimination to prudently handle all the income received. We can apply this same principle effectively to spiritualize our family's monthly income by ceremoniously setting aside the first portion for God. Each time you receive a paycheck, take it into your shrine room, perform a Ganesha Arati, invoking his blessings of Siddhi and Buddhi, and write a check for a religious donation, a tithe or lesser amount. Then thank Lord Ganesha for his blessings of abundance. Tell him that you will spend the income according to your monthly household budget. So that's a way of getting into a habit, shall we say. A simple way of forming a habit so that we don't get our paycheck and run out and spend it wildly on our wish list without thought, but we first dedicate it to God, make a religious contribution, and then take a look at our budget and say, okay, how does this fit into my budget? How can I wisely spend this money, not covetously spend it? One last thought. Gurudeva brings up one last area in Asteya. Interesting area. It's applying it in a broader sense. So we can apply the concept of stealing to community, national, and global issues. So the example that Gurudeva chose was major pollution of the environment is also a form of stealing. So why is that? Who is stealing from whom here? Well, the current generation is stealing from future generations. We're taking away something and giving a big problem. We're taking away a clean earth. And we're passing on the obligation to fix this to a future generation. We're not giving them any money to fix it, any solutions. We're just doing it, polluting the environment and passing on this problem to the future. So it's like we're stealing from the children and the children's children in a serious way, giving them a big problem. So that same concept applies to community as well as national issues. In a community, the current generation can be causing problems for future generations and not properly thinking about it, not taking on the obligation to not cause these kinds of problems and pass them on with no solutions and no funds to solve them. So again, don't have any shoplifters or bank robbers here this morning, but we can see that there's a lot of subtlety in this concept of non-stealing that we might not have thought about without Gurudeva's wonderful insights into it. And certainly, it's worth reflecting upon to see if we can harness even further this instinctive tendency to acquire, hoard, stow away just for ourselves, even if it requires stealing, and replace it with generosity and a religious sense of giving. Last week we enjoyed being with members in the San Francisco area and drove through San Francisco on our way over to Concord. We had a nice meeting too with Markandeya Paramount. Got to visit him at his rest home there. He's very comfortable. He's very happy that we took the time to come by and see him. And so one of the sites, we passed the Transamerica building and it stimulated my muladhara. I remembered many years ago watching it being built, and specifically the foundation being built. I'm not sure how many of us had that experience, but first of all, they started out by digging a very, very deep hole, okay, much deeper than you would expect. Put steel in it, and then filled it all up with concrete. They had this very long queue of cement trucks there, pouring all this concrete into the foundation. So it was amazing, the size of the structure they created underground. And of course, they did that because the building was tall and subject to earthquakes, and they didn't want it to fall down in an earthquake. So there it stands. So likewise, on the spiritual path, we need a strong foundation, just as a building needs one. And of course, as we've talked about before, on the spiritual path, the foundation is good character. Strong character being a disciplined, virtuous person, that's what provides us the foundation in our spiritual life. And some of you will remember that when Gurudeva returned from the European inner search, for one reason or another, that was one of his core messages. He was saying that, particularly for new students, Master Course students, should focus first on character building. In other words, let's start with the basics. Let's create the foundation first, which gives the stability. So, if we don't have good character, if we have poor character, and we try and pursue the sadhana marga, when we hit difficult times in our life, we could call them karmic earthquakes, so to speak. When we hit the difficult times in our life, if we haven't created a foundation of good character, we're going to flounder. We're not going to be able to sustain our spiritual efforts. Our life is going to go into a state of disruption. We'll start expressing some of our negative habits that we haven't conquered, and we'll stop doing our sadhana, and we'll lose good portion or possibly even all of the spiritual progress we've made up to that point simply because we don't have the foundation in place to sustain a bump, to sustain a difficult time. We've started not at the beginning of the path, we've started at the middle or the end of the path in hopes of pursuing it with a shortcut. It takes a lot of patience to actually start where we should on the path, to start at the beginning. So we've been talking a lot about building character the last few months, and the most common way we've stressed is observing the yamas and niyamas. That's a very important way to build up good character. So today we wanted to look at another way in which good character is built, and that's through vratas, vows, religious observances. So as we know, vrata is making a promise to observe certain religious practices in a strict manner. Often vratas relate to a specific festival, like someone will take a vrata for the 6 days of Skandashashti. That's common, and so for all 6 days, they'll fast during the day and go to the temple for Skanda Puja, and then at night, they'll have their meal. And then on the seventh day, it's done. Likewise, we have Vinayaka Vratam. That even has the name Vrata right in the festival name. Gives us a clue what it's for. Maybe this is for Vratas. So a 21-day Ganesha Vrata, some Ganesha devotees take every year, in fact, and do the same thing, fast during the day, go to puja, and then eat only at night. in the July issue of Hinduism Today, we had another kind of rakta related to the Sabarimala Ayyappan pilgrimage. And the vrata includes preparation. In other words, it doesn't start on the first day of a festival. It includes 41 days of preparation for a pilgrimage. So we've taken this vrata to include not only the pilgrimage, but the 41 days of preparation that precede it. So it takes 40-some plus days, the 41 plus a few to make the pilgrimage, is the duration of the vrata. So all of these vratas that we've talked about, these three examples, have one thing in common. They end. Skanda Shashti Vrata on the seventh day. Eat breakfast and lunch. Stay home. Vinayaka Vrata, it's over after 21 days. Sabarimala, it's over when the pilgrimage is done. So we've taken a vrata for a specific period of time. It has a beginning and an end. However, as we all know, there's another type of vrata that Gurudeva has given us, and that's a permanent vrata, a vrata that we take for the balance of our life. And of course, that's a more serious commitment. It doesn't end after 6 days or 21 days. It's permanent. So usually, someone will practice the disciplines of the vrata for a few months or a few years before they take it. That's the best way. And that way, they're assured a much better chance of successfully fulfilling it, because they have been fulfilling it already. You don't want to take a permanent vrata that you've never done. There's a good chance you might not be able to uphold it, and that creates a negative impression in the subconscious. You want to practice for a while, a couple of months, a couple of years before you take the vrata. Then when you take it, you have a solid habit of already doing it. So as we know, there's three vratas that are of this nature. And first is Shakahara Vrata, governing diet. Second is Parampara Vrata, which governs the study of spiritual teachings. Third is Dasamabhaga Vrata, which governs our finance. So there's more to each of these vratas than may initially strike us, and that's some of the depth that Gurudeva explores in Sabhidharma Shastras, which we'll touch on next. So Gurudeva makes a statement, the vegetarian vow builds character through the control of appetite, which is control of the instinctive mind. So that's an interesting statement, that control of appetite is control of the instinctive mind. So what does that mean? Well, it means as we get better in controlling our appetite, meaning eating the right amount, not eating between meals, eating the right foods, and so forth, as we get better in disciplining ourselves, control of our appetite, control of the other emotions, instinctive emotions such as anger and jealousy, also improves, goes along with it. That's what Gurudeva is saying. So if we focus on appetite, we actually improve the other instinct, control of the other instincts as well. So it's an excellent way of getting better control of the instinctive mind, because it's so tangible. You know, controlling anger or jealousy. You know, was I jealous today? Did I control my jealousy today? You know, it's a little bit vague, right? I mean, how do we see jealousy? How do we remember what we did? But we know what we ate. Okay, I ate 5 times today. That's too many, or I ate the wrong thing, or, you know, I ate too much. It's more objective, right? We can see it. We can remember it in a much easier way, and therefore it's an easier discipline to manage, to control our appetite rather than, say, controlling our jealousy. So Shakahara Vrata, of course, starts with avoiding the non-vegetarian foods. We all know that, meat, fish, fowl, and eggs. It also includes eating healthy foods, a balanced diet, avoiding junk foods, avoiding frozen foods, foods with too many chemicals, good quality foods. also includes mittahara, moderate appetite, not eating too much. It also includes not eating between meals. Not eating between meals is an interesting discipline, sometimes not fully cognized as to the importance of it, but there's a chapter in the Tirukkural, written whenever, 2,000 years ago or something. It's called Marandit, Medicine. And about the first 7 verses talk about what we eat. So keep stressing that the health is very dependent upon our eating habits. And so one of the verses points out this issue of not eating between meals. Once digestion is complete, eat with moderation. That is the way to prolong the life of the body. There's about 2 or 3 other verses saying the same thing in slightly different ways. Don't eat between meals. Let the food you've eaten fully digest before you eat again. This is the way we stay healthy. Also is the way we control the instinctive mind and fulfill the vow of Shakahara. Parampara Vrata is very interesting, and again, we may not fully cognize all the depths of it. Of course, we know it means studying Gurudeva's teachings, not studying somebody else's teachings. That's easy, Parampara Vrata. And as it says, it's control of mental and philosophical ramification, which is control of the intellect. Giving loyalties to a lineage precludes all extraneous training and requires closing off intellectual inroads to all other lineages, not reading their books, not taking their courses. Gurudeva has a nice description of this. This commitment is a total focus demanded of the Shishya by the Shishya himself, so that learning of one unique path may mature past intellectual states into completely experiential knowing. So in thinking about this, I remembered a conversation I had with a Hindu doctor a few months ago, and a young doctor from Canada, very interested in spiritual life, and was a bit disappointed the way his profession was working out. It wasn't all he envisioned it to be when he started medical school in his younger days. It wasn't as fulfilling as he thought it would be. And one of the reasons was patients didn't follow his advice. Now, he'd give very sound advice, and they wouldn't follow it, and therefore they wouldn't improve. And usually when you go to a doctor, you get advice like eat less fatty foods. That's a common one. You know, exercise more, and take certain medicines. So, of course, what usually happens? You usually don't do it all, right? Well, you go at it a little bit. You cut back on the foods for a while, but exercise, that takes too much time, and I don't have time to exercise. And the medications, well, you, as soon as they run out, you let them go. It's too much trouble to keep them in stock and take them and all. So after a few months, you're not following what was suggested at all. You've just gradually backed off of it, and of course the medical problem doesn't improve. So you get concerned about the medical problem and you try another doctor. You know, and they give similar advice, you know, maybe a little bit different kinds of exercises, different kind of diet restrictions, different medications. You follow it for a while, slack off. A year later, the problem's still there. You go to a third doctor. This is what people do. So, consequently, you know, they're getting different advice, but they're never fully applying it to their life, and consequently, the problem is not solved. So, this is like the spiritual path. And it's very easy for people who are wanting to have a spiritual life to do the same thing. They start studying these teachings with this Swami. It's going along just great. Really, really fascinating. There's all this new intellectual material they're learning and so forth. But then they're asked to do a few things And some of the things they're asked to do, they don't like to do. So, what do? Well, you start another study, right? You go over here, well, another Swami over here, another set of intellectual teachings, you learn it, it's very fascinating. You get up to the point of having to do things you don't want to do, and again, you don't do them. Just like going to the doctor, you don't do what you're supposed to do. And consequently, jumping around from study to study without making full progress. So Gurudeva describes the new age in that way. It's the they're committed to being non-committed. And I've heard him, I'm sure we've all heard him speak to many new age people in that way, you know, that stop shopping around and choose a path and follow it. Can't really make progress if you just dabble here for a while, for a few years, and then jump over here, dabble here for a few years, then go over here. You're not really going to make any spiritual progress. You're just entertaining the intellect. You're refusing to refrain the intellect from ramifying. So that's the essence of the Parampara Vrata, which harnesses the intellect. Of course, as the intellect is harnessed in its spiritual studies, it tends to ramify less in other areas as well. Just automatically carries over. We don't jump around in other areas unnecessarily ramifying, but naturally focus more on what we should. So in thinking this through, the analogy with the doctor here reminded me of Markandu Swami's description of Yoga Swami. Maybe some of you had the privilege of hearing him. He would use the phrase, in describing Yoga Swami, of course, Markandu Swami, every word was talking about Yoga Swami. You know, that was his discipline. He would never talk about himself or anything else, as a matter of the weather or whatever. You know, Yoga Swami said, Yoga Swami did this. You know, it was his total message. So he would put it in this phrase. He would say, Yoga Swami would give a different prescription to everyone who came to him. Just like medical advice, we're talking about different prescription. So specifically what Markandu Swami said is, he gave to each who came a different prescription. He could tell the difference between an MA and a kindergarten student. He gave to each according to the advancement. Then he lists some of the prescriptions. Realize the self by yourself. See God everywhere. See everyone as God. Be like water on a lotus leaf. Do meditation. Do service to others.